You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Robert Bounds. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we hear from one of the leading experts on Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula about the state of that shadowy group and their capacity to continue taking their war to the West. Plus, we'll pick through the detail of a damning new report from the United States, which details the true and truly astonishing cost to the country of congestion.
The big number is $121 billion. That's the amount in U.S. dollars that traffic jams and congestion and wasted time on the road has cost the U.S. economy. That's back in 2011.
And we go all the way back to the Ice Age to hear about a very new special exhibition at the British Museum.
And when you first come through the door, we see people thinking, oh, what's the name of the artist who did that? Expecting it to be a modern piece. And then they approach the case and discover it's 23,000 years old.
All that plus some music with a Colombian flavour too, all to come here in the next hour on Midori House. But first, it is of course news time with Jonathan Wheatley.
Russia has today said that it has killed the last surviving insurgent wanted for organising twin bombings on the Moscow metro that killed 40 people in 2010. Moscow is fighting an Islamist insurgency in the mountainous North Caucasus. Almost daily violence is reported in the volatile region, but insurgents have also struck the Russian heartland, claiming responsibility for a suicide bombing that killed 37 at Moscow's busiest airport in 2011 and the metro bombings in 2010. At least five people in a remote part of the Solomon Islands have been killed by a three-foot-high tsunami triggered by a powerful earthquake. The Pacific Tsunami Warning Center says the quake, measuring 8 on the Richter scale, struck 200 miles east of Kirikira. Australia's Foreign Minister Bob Carr says his country is ready to offer any help it can.
We're waiting to get information on the damage done in Santa Cruz, and we're very, very eager to assist if the government of the Solomons thinks Australia can help.
India has pledged not to let defence cuts disrupt efforts to finalise a potential $10 billion purchase of French warplanes ahead of a visit by President François Hollande next week. India picked a combat jet made by Dassault Aviation over a year ago, but is still to finalise the 126-aircraft deal. Well, Indian Defence Minister A.K. Antony said the deal was not related to the budget cuts.
There's no question of delay because of the budget cut. We want to clean the contract at the earliest, at the same time, you want to see at every stage of the procedure, no malpractice is there. Yes. Expenditure is essential for the operational preparedness of armed forces. That is our first priority. Regarding operational preparedness, there will be any kind of cuts.
Jemima Khan, a celebrity backer of Julian Assange who put up bail money for him, has now gone public with her frustrations about the WikiLeaks founder, saying he should face justice after all in Sweden. Assange's whistleblowing website angered Washington by releasing thousands of US diplomatic cables in 2010. He was arrested in Britain in December 2010 on an extradition warrant from Sweden, where he's wanted for questioning over allegations of rape and sexual abuse made by two women there. After losing a protracted legal battle to avoid extradition, Assange jumped bail and sought refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy here in London last June. He has been inside that building ever since. European Union leaders are expected to reach a deal on the EU's next seven-year budget at a summit beginning tomorrow, overcoming divisions over spending rather than accepting failure. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has accused the EU of living in a parallel universe and said savings could be made in areas like administration, agriculture and funding for poor regions.
There's no excuse whatever for not taking a much tougher approach towards the EU's administrative costs. Now, in the UK, we are cutting admin budgets of departments by a third, cutting civil service staff more than 10% in 2 years and reforming public sector pensions for the first time in decades. None of this has been easy, but we've done it, as have many other national governments. Meanwhile, Brussels continues to exist as if it is in a parallel universe.
And finally, a German teenager looking for a job was told to report for duty in a brothel by the local labour office, a German newspaper has reported today. The 19-year-old woman said she was horrified when she opened a job placement letter from the German labour office in Augsburg, informing her that it had lined up a waitressing job for her at the Augsburg Coliseum brothel. She said she was looking for a decent housekeeping job, not working at a brothel bar, and was totally shocked when she read the letter. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Okay, thank you very much, Jonathan Wheatley. It's 18:05 here in London, and you're tuned, therefore, of course, into Midori House. All right, it's 18:06 here in London. We're coming to you live from Studio One. We cross to Mali, first of all, amid news that the French president, François Hollande, is pressing ahead with his plans to draw down the numbers of French troops in the African state by the end of next month. But how credible are these plans? Will Hollande have to resign himself to retaining some presence in Mali even after the drawdown of troops is complete? Who indeed will fill the vacuum left? And what will any occupying or security force remaining in Bamako, for example, actually look like? Well, joining me on the line now to help answer these questions is Reuters journalist based in Dakar, Joe Penny, himself recently returned from Mali. Joe, welcome to Midori House.
Well, hi, how are you doing?
Very good, thanks. First of all, is Mali in a state, or will it be in a state in a month for French troops to draw out from?
Well, Mali's own security forces will definitely not be able to handle the withdrawal of French troops. The question is whether the French troops can be replaced with African troops. Just today, Laurent Fabius, the foreign minister of France, announced that he wants a UN-backed peacekeeping force by the end of April. It's not so clear whether that will replace or coincide with the ECOWAS, which is the West African Regional Grouping Force of 8,000 soldiers. But what's clear right now is that France is the one in charge of the military operation in Mali, and efforts to pull out troops from French troops and replace them with African troops remains a question that only France and the West African groups can answer at the moment.
And we heard about British troops going over to Mali last week. Cameron was in Paris talking about that. Is this part and parcel of the idea to train up African troops as soldiers and as police in lieu of the French troops that are leaving?
Yeah, that's the plan right now, is to actually have 8,000 African troops from regional grouping ECOWAS replace the French soldiers. But right now, there's a lot of questions remaining about that force. They don't have enough money. Nobody has pledged enough money. They're asking for about $1 billion for the first year alone for 8,000 troops. They don't have training. Right now, there are only 2,000 troops on the ground from West African countries. They don't have the skills. They don't have the equipment. It seems to me that we're still a long way off from replacing French troops with African ones.
And as far as the game plan for the French troops is concerned, they were obviously brought in to get rid of these Islamists. Have they defeated them or simply scattered them far and wide?
Well, it seems to me that they've been successful beyond initial expectations in at least clearing the three major towns, Timbuktu, Gao, and Kidal, of the jihadist fighters. But the question is, where have they gone? The French Foreign Ministry and Defense Ministry say that they're in the Adra des Iforas, which is the mountains northeast of Kidal, near the borders with Niger and Algeria. But it's not really clear whether they've actually been defeated or whether they've been dispersed. There aren't many journalists on the ground because the French block access to combat zones. So we don't know how many numbers there are, and we don't know exactly what their military strategy is. What is clear, though, is that France has definitely dealt with them in the towns of Timbuktu and Gao, very very handily, and they're in complete control of those towns. But outside of those towns, there's still skirmishes going on, and they're still targeting jihadist depots and training centers with airstrikes every day.
And Joe, you mentioned mountains and borders there in terms of the dispersed jihadists. These are two of the things that frighten the life out of any sort of occupying force. It means guerrilla war, doesn't it? How does that stop being made to happen in Mali?
Well, before the war, and about 3 years ago, Al-Qaeda maintained a presence in northern Mali, but was basically confined to these northern mountains. And I think the plan is not necessarily to eradicate Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, but to contain them into these mountains where there are no real fuel supplies, there are no food supplies, where they will have a hard time carrying out operations. So rather than eradicate them entirely, it seems to me that the plan is to confine them into a space where they can't really operate efficiently.
And just finally, who's likely to replace the French as top military dogs in Mali when they start to move out? Who's going to take the place in that power vacuum?
Well, right now there's the Malian military, which will, although it's the power that it has is very little real in terms of real power. But there's the ECOWAS force, which is called AFISMA. That is led by a Nigerian commander. So it will be Nigerian and other West African commanders who will be in charge. But definitely France will maintain a lot of decision-making power in terms of military operations in Mali in the future.
Okay, Joe, thank you very much. That was Joe Penny talking to me from Dakar about the French troop withdrawal from Mali. He of Reuters, of course. Coming up next, we ask why so many Germans are getting caught up in academic plagiarism.
From a breed of Italian sheep brought back from extinction to vintage recipes revitalising the dairy business in a remote part of Norway, Monocle Films brings you inspiring tales of mountain producers on a mission.
Mikhail's restaurants depend on locally sourced produce for its recipes, which have attracted a faithful following. It's proof, if ever proof were needed, that when restaurants work in collaboration with local food producers, it's possible to make a sustainable business out of organic farming and to create a distinct regional culinary identity.
Making it work in the mountains on monocle.com.
Join us at midday London time every weekday for The Briefing, Monocle 24's fast-paced, hour-long roundup of global breaking news stories, in-studio analysis, and a first look at the North American front pages. And for those waking up on the East Coast, it's the perfect way to get a Monocle take on the stories you need to know at the start of each day. The Briefing, live at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York and 6 a.m. in Chicago.
All right, it's 18:13 here in London. You're tuned in to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, Germany's education minister has become the latest high-profile politician in the country to be found guilty of plagiarising portions of a doctoral dissertation. Rather ironic, no? And she's not the only one. In early 2011, Germany's then defence minister, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, resigned after it became known that he had plagiarised large chunks of his thesis. Since then, plagiarist hunters have taken it upon themselves to look into the doctoral dissertations of well-known politicians and check whether they were plagiarised. So why does Germany seem to have such a problem with plagiarism? Well, a little earlier, our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield spoke to Andrew Bulkley, a regular Monocle contributor based in Berlin, to find out more.
I imagine a number of students across Germany will have a wry smile or two this morning.
I think actually a lot of people have a wry smile this morning. I think anybody who doesn't like Minister Chauvin is smiling this morning. But, you know, this has been dragging on for almost a year, and it actually sounds like it's going to drag on for a lot longer now as well.
Let's talk about this specific case first before we broaden it out. As you say, I mean, she was accused about a year ago. There's been an investigation. And what has that investigation shown us?
Well, last May, there's an anonymous website. It's a guy, I think he calls himself Robert Schmidt or something like that, published this website that goes through her dissertation and lays out the various areas where this person feels Siobhan plagiarized things. And there's different degrees in there where it looks like she just didn't cite something or just took something wholesale. And then that, of course, got picked up by the German press, who approached her and said, what do you think about this? And eventually the University of Dusseldorf, where she got her doctoral, then picked it up, and they put together a committee that looked at this, at her doctoral thesis and these accusations. And it was a 14-member committee, and this morning, I'm pretty sure it was 14, it was 12 or 14, and this morning they came back and said, yes, indeed, this thing is stolen, and I think there was one abstention. But so it looked kind of bad for her. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a split decision. It was the entire committee has come out and said, yeah, this thing is not good, and they took away her title.
Now, obviously, this is politically tricky for Angela Merkel. Siobhan is one of her closest allies. It's still not clear yet whether she is going to resign. She's apparently currently on a trip to South Africa, so that's going to be tricky for her. But I mean, politically, what are the potential ramifications for this?
Well, it's hard to say. Gutenberg, this has kind of a different feel to it. The Gutenberg thing, the defense minister, which was in 2011, it pretty much looked like he stole the whole thing. I don't think anybody believes that he had much to do with that at all. I mean, much to do with the thesis itself. It came from somebody else. This one sort of seems like maybe she just took parts, or maybe, I guess if you believe her story, she just cited it incorrectly, but it doesn't quite have the same feel as that. And so it's unclear what the political implication. She says she's going to fight it legally in the German court system. That means years. So, of course, you have this presumption of innocence until you're found guilty. So she could conceivably hold on. Merkel's going to have to form a new government next September after general elections. So theoretically, she could just say, well, you know, I'm fighting it and I oppose it, and then sort of gracefully bow out next September when the new government comes in.
Now, let's look at this issue of plagiarism. I mean, you know, some people, you know, we've been speaking to say, well, look, it's, you know, part of the reason is that, you know, some Germans have this fear of being too original and breaking new ground, so they tend to copy things. It becomes a bit too close to the original. I mean, is there something in that? Is there something specifically German about this, or is it just slightly unfortunate?
I don't think the plagiarism itself is specifically German. If you look around Europe, it doesn't take too long until you find other government officials that are being accused of this. I think there's one in Turkey, Bulgaria, Romania. This happens a lot, and I think all you have to do is look back at your own 20s when you were under a lot of pressure to finish schooling, maybe start your career, you had a lot going on in your personal life, and you think, who's going to care about paragraph 3 on page 15? I'm going to throw this in here and I can get on with my life. What I think this plagiarism thing has to do in Germany specifically is because, you know, academia is sort of the serious side of life, and Germany is a country known for its seriousness, so they take academia doubly serious. And these doctoral titles are a big deal here. In fact, they're protected by law. You can't claim to be a doctor, have a doctoral title, or a professor. You can't be a professor or even an engineer. You can't use abbreviations in your name as a title unless you actually have them. So it's a big deal here. And also, I think that Germans, you know, they just love to be busybodies. So there's these people, you know, sitting around on their computers and saying, I really don't like this Siobhan. Let's look at her doctoral thesis. And even, you know, turn to Uncle Google. He can help you find out where these things are stolen from these days. And it goes even deeper. There's software now that helps you search for much deeper sources for plagiarism. So it's just, I think this German fascination with being a busybody and uncovering somebody is why this keeps coming up in Germany.
And that was Steve Bloomfield talking to Monocle's Berlin contributor Andrew Bulkley about Germany's political elite being caught out for academic plagiarism earlier on. Up next, we'll be learning about the true cost of congestion. It's 18:19 here in London. If you've ever been stuck in a traffic jam on your way to an important business meeting and wondered exactly how costly your tardiness might prove to be, then an answer may be close at hand. The Texas A&M Transportation Institute has finally managed to put a figure on what all that time and fuel really costs. The answer? $121 billion. That's no small change. And so, as furious traffic choke commuters often ask, would it not be more economical to spend a fraction of that sum on improving the roads and infrastructure in order to speed people on their way? To try and answer that question, Monocle's Tom Edwards spoke to our transport editor, Tristan McAllister, in New York, and asked him to explain the key findings of that report.
It goes back to 2011, and we're just seeing the data sort of compiled in a cohesive manner now, but it goes back to 2011. The big number is $121 billion. That's the amount in U.S. dollars that traffic jams and congestion and wasted time on the road has cost the U.S. economy. That's back in 2011. The report says that for these jams, each American consumer paid $818. And then of that $121 billion, $27 billion of that was for lorry or long-haul truck wait times and fuel consumption. So it's sort of insane when you think about the economic impact of a bad infrastructure and traffic jams.
And I guess, you know, that's only the start of it. When we get into, I mean, what's the environmental cost, both in terms of real damage and money, that's being wreaked when you've got these huge trucks, cars sitting in these mega jams? I mean, that's going to cost a lot of money and worse besides as well, isn't it?
Right, of course. And I think that, unfortunately, the environmental side always seems to come secondary in these studies, at least in terms of how people care about them. But the environmental side is very big. 56 billion pounds of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere just from vehicles sitting there and waiting. And then not to mention the economic waste in terms of fuel. I don't have the number on that, but obviously very, very big if 56 billion pounds of carbon dioxide are just being spewed into the atmosphere for really no reason. So that, again, there's a lot of gravity in that number.
Now, another one of the things that people always like to look at when these kind of reports come out is, who's the worst offender? How is it broken down geographically? Who should we be getting most angry about? Which city is at top of the list?
Well, I think, you know, of course, there are the typical culprits. New York City is on the list. Chicago's on the list. Los Angeles is on the list. But coming in at number one, and I think, ironically, it's Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, which I think if you spend any time there, you know, it's a very well-kept city. They have a nice public transportation. I would argue it's not as extensive as maybe it needs to be, or not necessarily as thorough or extensive as the one in New York City is. But D.C. is the worst. They said on average, drivers spent 3 hours getting to places where it should really only take them 20 minutes to get. So that doesn't bode well for Washington, D.C., but it really does seem indicative of a bigger problem overall. And a lot of it is that these cities, given the rise of car culture in the United States, these cities just were not built for the infrastructure challenges that they would be facing. And a lot of that is coming home to roost. So that's where we're seeing a lot of the power in these numbers.
So tell me then, Tristan, with your transport expertise hat on, what can these cities do better then? Places like DC, you know, you tend to think they're pretty well structured. As you said, mass transit systems generally have a pretty good reputation. What are they doing wrong, and what could they do better to turn these kind of figures around?
You know, it's a multifaceted solution. At least that's what they suggest. And, you know, in my opinion, and in the findings in this particular study from Texas A&M, we see that they sort of lay it out as it's a mixed mass transit, light rail, high occupancy lanes, even things like flexible work hours and telecommuting. I mean, those things seem so minuscule in the grand scheme of things, but aggregated in these environments where you have millions of people on the road, I think those things would make a difference. In a place like Los Angeles, for instance, you have a lot of stigmas around public transportation. So you do have, in some respects, capacity in certain corridors where they could put people on public transit, but it's just getting people into that mental framework of thinking about using it. And I think that, you know, what comes with that is the idea that, you know, gas prices are at this point where I think we may see, if they get higher, a tipping point where people really will opt for the mass transit options if they can. They really will opt for carpooling. They may ask their bosses for flexible work hours or telecommuting. I don't know how successful they'll be, but it seems that there are ways to fix it, but it definitely is multifaceted and it really varies by city.
Now, Tristan, we'd be forgiven, I guess, sometimes for thinking the US is the worst place in the world for this. It seems to often be demonized, particularly, as you say, some of these cities with the particular problems. But I guess there's some small reassurance, isn't there, for our listeners who are in the US. The Americans aren't the only country that's struggling to get to grips with this kind of problem, are they?
No, and I can tell you that I think one of the examples that really popped to mind, just because I was there recently and doing a bit of reporting on this, was the transit situation in a place like Bangkok, Thailand. And not to single them out, but you know, these are examples from all over the world, or at least that this fits into a category for all over the world. But Bangkok has a road infrastructure really built for 1.5 to 2 million cars. And on the roads in Bangkok, you're seeing 6 to 7 million cars. So, you know, that sort of exemplifies the problem that we're dealing with in a lot of these emerging economies and just a lot of metropolitan areas, major metropolitan areas around the world. If I can say one thing real quick, there is some good news in all of this, at least for the United States. In 2005, that was the worst, at least according to all the metrics they used in this study. And they're saying that it has improved since. Now, the caveat on that is that we don't know if the improvements are only because of the economic downturn and the recession. So that really remains to be seen.
And that was Tristan McAllister talking to Jeremy Clarkson. I mean, Tom Edwards, sorry, I always get those two confused, about the cost of congestion a little earlier on. It's 1825. You're tuned in to Midori House.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, dette er Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
It so is Monocle 24. It's 1827 here in London. Time for a song before the bottom of the hour. This from his upcoming record, Amala, is Devendra Banhart with For Hildegard von Bingen.
She's leaving. Congregation left the abbeys. Suffocation. She's been dreaming.
Nice and chill. Devendra Banhart there with For Hildegard von Bingen from the new record called Amala. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be talking Colombia and heading all the way back to the Ice Age.
And when you first come through the door, we see people thinking, oh, what's the name of the artist who did that? Expecting it to be a modern piece. And then they approach the case and discover it's 23,000 years old.
But first, it's news time with Jonathan Wheatley.
Rob, thanks very much. Russia has today said that it has killed the last surviving insurgent wanted for organising twin bombings on the Moscow metro that killed 40 people in 2010. At least five people in a remote part of the Solomon Islands have been killed by a three-foot-high tsunami triggered by a powerful earthquake which measured 8 on the Richter scale and struck 200 miles east of Kirikira. India has pledged not to let defence cuts disrupt efforts to finalise a potential $10 billion purchase of French warplanes ahead of a visit by President François Hollande next week. Jemima Khan, a celebrity backer of Julian Assange, who put up bail money for him, has gone public with her frustrations about the WikiLeaks founder, saying he should face justice after all in Sweden. And European Union leaders are expected to reach a deal on the EU's next seven-year budget at a summit beginning tomorrow, overcoming divisions over spending rather than accepting failure. The British Prime Minister David Cameron said savings could be made in areas like administration, agriculture and funding for the poor regions. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Okay, you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, 1831. Just today, we learnt of the existence of a secret US drone airbase in Saudi Arabia, perfectly positioned to coordinate the American hunt for Yemen-based members of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But what does this shadowy group look like? And to what extent are they equipped to wage a coherent war against the West? Well, a new book, The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda and the Battle for Arabia, the leading Yemen expert Gregory D. Johnson explores these questions and the very state of Islamic radicalism in the Middle East. I'm delighted to say that Gregory joins us now live from our studio in New York City. Gregory, welcome to Midori House.
Thanks so much for having me.
We should address perhaps the title of your book, The Last Refuge. Is Yemen really the last place of hiding for Al-Qaeda?
Right, that's a great question. The title comes from a what some people call apocryphal hadith of the Prophet Muhammad. And so this was way back several centuries ago at the beginning of Islam when the Prophet Muhammad was still an outcast. Islam really hadn't taken off. He gathered his men together and he said, when disaster threatens, seek refuge in Yemen. And this was the words of really a general on the eve of battle. Of course, at that point, history sort of turned around. Islam took over, conquered the Middle East and North Africa. But Muhammad's words lived on. And when Al-Qaeda was suffering setbacks in Iraq and in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, they really used that hadith and they regrouped in Yemen, and from Yemen, now we've seen them expand out into North Africa and other places. So for a while, it was the last refuge, and out of this base, they're growing.
And you mentioned that they obviously had this tradition, this history of the Hadith. Strangely, it seemed in news, post 9/11 news, that Yemen was the last country we heard of. Why is that?
Yemen has been, I mean, right after September 11th, there was a threat of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, and then the U.S. and the Yemeni governments did a very good job of really destroying the organization. But what happened is that in February 2006, 23 Al-Qaeda prisoners tunneled out of a maximum security prison in Sana'a into a neighboring mosque where they just dusted themselves off, said their morning prayers, and they walked out the front door to freedom. And that moment, that prison break, was really the genesis of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, this group that's attempted to assassinate the UK ambassador in Yemen, the group that's put a would-be suicide bomber on a plane over the United States on Christmas Day 2009.
And is Yemen such a stronghold? And as your book's titled, The Last Refuge for Al-Qaeda, because we in the West are perhaps a little ignorant of it. We have relations with Saudi Arabia and with the rest of the Middle East and North Africa, perhaps better ones than we have with what is perhaps still a far-off land to us.
Right. Yemen's right at the tip of the Arabian Peninsula, and this is a country that got rid of its president in 2011, 2012. It was one of the Arab Spring countries. But unlike, say, Tunisia, where the president went into exile, or Libya, where the president was killed, or even Egypt, where the president went to prison, in Yemen, the president stepped down, but he's still a political player. So Yemen is a very complex and a very murky situation. The military's divided, and actually what we've seen recently is that Al-Qaeda has been able to take over towns and villages. They're doing things like building water wells, stringing electricity. In fact, they're even running schools, which is very, very worrying because you can imagine what it is they're teaching the young boys in these schools.
Well, this is the thing. How much about the interior of Yemen do we know? I mean, obviously, we're speaking to the man that possibly does, Gregory, luckily. But how much of the interior of it do we know? Not just in terms of the geography of it and the complications there for anyone trying to find out the facts or send spies abroad into Yemen, but in terms of the sort of the local makeup, the religious and ethnic makeup of the country.
Right. Well, I think that's the great thing about the book, or at least what I really tried to do, is this isn't a book for policymakers. This is a story. When you read the book, you really get to know the personalities of the individuals, and you see how Al-Qaeda really came to be in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. In fact, their first terrorist attack was in Yemen in 1992. How they grew and expanded, how they were defeated, and then how, when the U.S. and Yemeni governments really took their eye off the ball, how they were able to regroup. And so you get to know, in a very intimate sense, a guy by the name of Ibrahim Asiri, who's a college dropout from Saudi Arabia. And this is the guy who built the underwear bomb. And this is why, when we go to an airport, at least in the U.S., that we have to stand in these scanners and have a full body scan. And it's individuals like these that we may not know, that you come to know through the book, and they've changed the way it is that we live our lives today.
And do you think, Gregory, that we fear and respect Saudi Arabia, perhaps, and certainly have good reason, business reasons, to be cozy with them? But maybe we've underestimated Yemen in the West. Do you think there's part of that? Is that part of the story of your book as well?
Yeah, Yemen is a very difficult place to know. And of course, we're doing this interview, and tomorrow, John Brennan, who's been a key counterterrorism advisor to President Obama, will go before the Senate for confirmation hearings to take over as CIA director. John Brennan, of course, was the CIA station chief in Saudi Arabia. And John Brennan has worked very closely with Saudi intelligence in an attempt to really uproot Al-Qaeda in Yemen. So it's a U.S. and Saudi partnership. And in fact, in one of the stories right at the end of the book, there's a time where the U.S. and Saudi have hired these spies to infiltrate Al-Qaeda. They're putting electronic tracking chips into these cars that the U.S. then later uses to target them with drones. One of these individuals who was convicted by Al-Qaeda of putting these tracking chips in the cars was later executed. And in fact, Al-Qaeda, in a very gruesome manner in early 2012, brought him before the entire village, lashed him up on a metal street post, and actually crucified him. And Al-Qaeda brought one of the victim's children, one of the individuals who died in the drone strike. And so there's this image in the book of this little boy about 6 years old by the name of Salem pointing up at the man on the cross and saying, "There's the man who killed my father."
What are the particular challenges, Gregory, of Yemen? As I said, we talked about the history and the geography. Do those things play into the unique problem that is Yemen for the West to crack?
Right, and that's absolutely right. And I think one of the other things, and the real challenge that the U.S. is having in dealing with Yemen, is that unlike, say, in Afghanistan, where Al-Qaeda was largely Arabs in a non-Arab country, what you have in Yemen are Yemenis in Yemen who are members of Al-Qaeda. And so being able to know who's a tribesman who has a beard and carries a gun and looks like Al-Qaeda but isn't a member, and who's a guy who has a beard and carries a gun and actually is Al-Qaeda, and being able to hit the right people is incredibly difficult. And in fact, what we've seen is that the U.S. has made a lot of mistakes in these drone strikes. And these mistakes over the past 3 years in this bombing campaign that the U.S. has been carrying out in Yemen have actually strengthened Al-Qaeda. We've seen the organization grow from, in December 2009, about 200 or 300 individuals to today being well over 1,000. So instead of disrupting, dismantling, and defeating Al-Qaeda, the current U.S. and Western approach in Yemen is, at least in my view, actually exacerbating the threat and expanding Al-Qaeda.
And just finally, Gregory, how good's the timing of your book? Is Yemen the real linchpin, the real sort of leverage out for Al-Qaeda and its battle with the West?
Right. Well, I've been writing the book for quite some time, so timing is always difficult to peg to events. But unfortunately, what we're seeing is that Al-Qaeda is getting stronger in a place like Yemen rather than weaker.
All right. For the time being, Gregory D. Johnson on the line from New York City. Thank you very much. That was the author of The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda and the Battle for Arabia. It's 18:39 in London. You're tuned in to Midori House.
inspirational mayors, money-making gentrifiers, park creators, subway planners, tech hub upstarts, wayfinding geniuses, broom-toting road sweepers, stadium designers, all-seeing historians, and squawking birds. But they help make a city. You'll meet them on The Urbanist, Monocle's weekly show about the cities we live in, that's presented by me, Andrew Tuck.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Be our guest and come spend the weekend with Monocle 24. We kick off on Saturday with the Weekend Edition, a smart, relaxing selection of music, news headlines and great conversation.
There's real excitement there, you know, and it's sort of like, wow, I don't really understand what they're doing, but I love the sound of it.
Then join us for our brand new show, The Stack, celebrating the world of print media, from chunky Korean glossies to fine-tuned Brazilian newspapers. Hosted by Tyler Brulé, each week we pull in guest reviewers to crack open spines and thumb through inky pages to reveal why there's more to journalism than going digital.
The publication you have in your hand is all about women across the Middle East. The one in your hand is about skiing in Morocco. They have one about the Saudi pavilion in the Osaka Expo. So it was very progressive.
Later, this Saturday review casts a critical eye over the week's literature, music, TV, cinema and the arts, and delivers some fun, fast-paced conversation too.
It's a bit of a riot, actually. They just boiled the crayfish in water.
That sounds like a riot so far.
On Sunday, stay over for the Monocle Weekly, our longest-running radio show that brings our editors face-to-face with everyone from academics to war correspondents, historians to social commentators, and serves up some fine music too.
I sort of came to Brazilian music quite late. Yeah, it's something that I'm still discovering.
And don't miss The Curator, our one-hour survey of the week's highlights on Monocle 24. That's the new weekend lineup on Monocle 24.
It's 1842 in London, which means you're tuned in to Midori House, live from Studio One here. And I'm Robert Bound. A new exhibition at the British Museum, opening tomorrow, will cover artists that are often neglected in the art world, the so-called prehistoric artists. With works from 40,000 to about 10,000 years ago, curator Jill Cook wanted to show how these Ice Age artists influenced many modern artists, such as Picasso, Matisse and Henry Moore. Picasso, for example, was very keen on a 23,000-year-old ivory sculpture of a large-breasted woman, the Scamp. Among other pieces, there's a replica of Lion Man, possibly the world's earliest figurative sculpture. The original one, unfortunately, needed further time to be reconstructed. Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, visited the show today and spoke to Jill Cook.
How was the Ice Age exhibition conceived?
Well, I've been working on many of the objects in the show for quite a long time, and when I show friends and colleagues pictures of what I do, they just say, well, we've never seen these wonderful things. Why don't we see them in the galleries?
It's quite interesting because you're treating those objects like art, not only as archaeological finds, correct?
That's right. Archaeologists, of course, want to go beyond the art and look at the societies and the technologies and the economies that produce these images. But in that way, also, you overburden the objects with other information. And we didn't want to put a book on the wall and explain human evolution and climate change and all the rest of it and have lots and lots of stone tools and how we differentiate between different periods and how we name them. We just decided that we would strip all that away and show you wonderful things.
Tell us a bit about this first piece that we're just at the entrance of the exhibition. Can you tell us a bit more about this? Is it the one that Picasso loved?
It is the one that Picasso loved. It's a little sculpture about the size of a 15-centimetre ruler in height. And it's a figure of a woman, and she's made on mammoth ivory. And she's very beautifully conceived, not realistic in detail. The figure has been observed, taken apart, reconstituted, perhaps as part of a fantasy or a spiritual dream. Beautifully conceived, the body is reformed into a wonderful lozenge-shaped symmetry. And she has these enormous breasts, which are quite out of keeping with the very thin, girlish shoulders and the bowed head with the long hair. She's a very beautiful figure. And when you first come through the door, we see people thinking, oh, what's the name of the artist who did that? Expecting it to be a modern piece. And then they approach the case and discover it's 23,000 years old. And immediately the time barrier has been broken.
Modern artists were hugely influenced by these pieces, isn't it?
I think at the turn of the 20th century, artists were looking at everything. And they were going beyond their own art history, beginning with Greece and Rome. They were looking around the world. They were looking at art from Africa and Polynesia and Australia, as well as taking on board this most ancient art. And they were influenced by it, but then produced completely their own ideas on what they were looking at. So I can't point to any particular work by any of the early 20th century artists that are directly inspired by this. But they do absorb ideas from it and then reproduce them in other ways. So I can prove their interest.
And you, if you don't mind, I'm looking to a very interesting piece of the exhibition. It's The Lion Man, which became quite famous.
It is a very famous and important figure. Sadly, we have a replica of it here rather than the real thing. But that is for the very good reason that the original is currently in pieces on the conservator's bench. The Germans were very willing to lend us the original, but we would have had to have waited another year before putting the show on, because what's happened is that recent excavation have produced new pieces, which mean that some of the gaps where the figure is damaged can now be filled properly.
It's a fascinating sculpture. It's a proof that they used imagination as well, right? Because that's a lion man, so that's not only the graphic depiction of an animal or of someone.
That's right. This is the piece which proves that these people who arrive in Europe, ultimately out of Africa, are not only physically like us, they're as smart as us. As you say, it's not something that actually exists. It's something that's imagined, something that's invented. And in order to imagine and invent, you have to have this fantastic prefrontal cortex that we have. And that's the battery that powers the mind and enables us to do all these important creative things. It really is the beginnings of us.
How do they depict the female figure? Because that's another influence I'm sure they had on the artists that came after then.
We can see here a lovely modern charcoal drawing by Ghislaine Howard, in which she depicts herself pregnant. And to one side of her, in the next case, you can see figures of women, some of whom are pregnant with their first child, others pregnant with clearly already had a child, and they may even be made by women for women. When they were originally found, they were thought to be about the male gaze and being erotic. But in actual fact, they're not really flirty at all, are they? They're looking down, they're not looking at you, giving you the come on, and their hands are tucked in, knees tight together, you know? So the reason that they were thought to be erotic was the people who found them didn't realise that they were pregnant. They just thought they were fat. And so they associated this as some sort of savage, lascivious, sexy idea that, you know, savages like fat women, and therefore these were erotic depictions from another age. We see them rather differently now. It's very nice actually to see women looking at them and relating to them.
And that was Fernando Augusto Pacheco talking to the curator Jill Cook at the British Museum of that Ice Age show. And you're tuned in to Midori House. All right, it's 1850 here in London. Now we're going to range our sights down to South America. I'm delighted to say that we're joined in studio here at Midori House by two of our Colombian experts. One is a Colombian, Santo Rodriguez Tarditi, our Section E editor. Welcome.
Hello, Rob.
And Anastasia Maloney, our Bogota correspondent. Welcome.
Hello.
We got you straight in here, didn't we? We said before we turned the microphones on, come in to look around the office, get straight in onto the radio.
No time, no rest for the wicked.
And luckily you did make some notes for us. You said that 2013 was the year, a make or break year for Colombia. That's fighting talk. How come?
Well, there's a lot going on in Colombia at the moment, which could define at least the near future of Colombia. There's a peace talks going on at the moment in Havana between the Colombian government and the FARC rebels. And they're there to try to sign a peace deal that, if they're successful, could end nearly 50 years of war. However, the peace talks have gone through a very tense stage, particularly last week, and there's no ceasefire at the moment. The FARC have kidnapped soldiers. The military offensive by the government continues, and it's very difficult to see a climate of trust and peace between the two sides at the moment while the peace talks go on. So that's why it's make or break, because this year could define whether these two sides actually sign a peace deal. The Colombian president, Santos, has said he wants peace deal signed by November of this year. If not, the government could walk out of peace talks. The FARC have said they're prepared to sit at the negotiating table indefinitely. So I think this year is make or break in terms of a possible peace process.
And have the economic benefit of peace been one of the key objectives? I guess it was kind of left or right, tit for tat for so many years. Presumably the success of business and the success of the economy, and that we can all, as Colombians, benefit from peace, that must have been a major selling point in recent years.
Yes, but the economy, with or without peace, has actually been booming in recent years. So Colombia's enjoyed a very robust economic growth. Foreign investment is record high. And the conflict, particularly in the last 5 years, hasn't really deterred foreign investors. And the FARC have been weakened recently, well, particularly over the last 10 years. And so foreign investors have actually been pouring into Colombia, particularly in the mining and oil industries. So the economy is doing really well despite the conflict going on.
And is it one of those conflicts where that takes foreigners along with it, or is it quite laser beam focused at people that are in FARC or in the government, or is it the sort of, I mean, we used to hear headlines in the 80s, I guess, when it was at its worst, of everybody being caught in the crossfire.
At the moment, the FARC have said that they're not going to kidnap people for ransom. So that would imply, if they keep to their promise, that foreigners are not being touched. However, they have kidnapped all workers during the last couple of years. So generally, foreigners wouldn't get caught up in the conflict. If you're a tourist in Bogota or travelling to most tourist parts in Colombia, you wouldn't feel the conflict, you wouldn't come into contact. So it's basically the crime rates, the murder rates in Colombia are actually not really linked to the conflict. It's drug-fueled crime.
I'd like to ask you this to both of you. How is this covered in the press and the TV? This is my seg from war to media. See, you could hear a pin drop, can't you, at that turning on a sixpence. But I wondered how this war's been covered and whether it's changed over the years, whether more people know more about it and the reporting of it gets more subtle.
Well, I think I grew up, of course, in Colombia, and I got used to watching every night the news with my family, and there would always be some sort of report of what was going on, and you kind of got used to that. And it was only when the conflict somehow invaded the city or your family or your group of friends that you actually felt and realized there was an ongoing conflict. Other than that, it kind of feels like just watching a report from a foreign country or whatnot. These days, the newspaper headlines have been more positive. The fact that there are ongoing peace talks is a refreshing idea, is a new prospect for the country. And I think we're starting to focus more on what we can do to empower the country in terms of its economy, of its image, of its hotel and travel infrastructure, and just focus on those positive aspects and try and leave the government to deal with the peace talks on the side.
In terms of positive aspects, then, as if 2013 is a make or break year for Colombia in terms of its peace, what are the exports? What are the things that we should be knowing about from Colombia that maybe we don't, because we see a FARC smokescreen in front of our eyes whenever we hear about foreign policy or sort of domestic problems?
Well, luckily, you already know some of Colombia's biggest exports: coffee, of course, flowers. But emeralds, we're producing or exporting 60% of the world's emeralds. We also have lots of natural resources in terms of mining, coal mining, oil. Something that's very interesting is quality of life. We won't export quality of life, but we will invite
people. People would kind of wonder about. You know, do you know what I mean? Because of these headlines.
Well, funnily enough, last year Colombia ranked as the happiest country in the world in a poll conducted by Gallup called the Global Barometer of Hope and Happiness.
That man alive. Well, that sounds like a sort of that sounds like it comes with that. That sounds like it comes with a toll free number. The poll of health and happiness.
And somehow, despite all of our problems, we managed to still continue to be one of the happiest countries in the world. We've always ranked very high in this.
All right, I've got to ask our insider outsider, our Bogota correspondent Anastasia Maloney, about that. Does that seem to fit with your view of the country as an insider sort of looking at?
The Colombians are the happiest people.
Yeah, Colombians
are
the happiest people.
And, yeah. Well, I think it depends who you speak to. There is a growing middle class. That's tangible. You can feel it, especially in Bogota and the other major cities. I've come across many people who are buying their first home for the very first time in their lives, and that's due to slightly easier access to credit and also government subsidies for social housing. So that's a real success story. And obviously, for the first time homeowners, they would obviously be very happy. There's people making a lot of money at the moment in Colombia. There's foreign investors, particularly in, as we mentioned, in the extractive industries, but also Colombian businessmen, particularly those who perhaps left during the 1980s when violence was very, very high. They've come back and now they're reinvesting again in their own country, rediscovering their own country again. So we've seen a lot of Colombians come back and put their money back into their country, and I think they would consider themselves extremely happy. However, there is a side where, still one in three Colombians is poor, and there's a lot of talk at the moment. The headlines is about reconciliation, is about a possible post-conflict scenario. It's about compensating victims and giving back people who've lost their land. Those are the headlines that are being talked about at the moment in Colombia.
We've got to end it there. We're going to probably pick up this theme, I should imagine, later on in the year, whether it's make or break, to get a progress report. For the time being, Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi, Section E editor for Monocle, and Anastasia Maloney, Bogota correspondent, thank you very much. That's all we have time for today on Midori House. Thanks to Tom Edwards, our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, our researcher, and Ben Jay, our studio manager. After the news, it's The Entrepreneurs, where we'll be speaking to Matt Watkinson, author of The 10 Principles Behind Great Customer Experiences, If You Can Possibly Bear It, about his hope for smarter and more original solutions to customer service.
If you set out to eliminate stress in a very proactive way, you come up with a better experience. And these principles are really all about giving you a simple checklist that you can follow that should result in a better experience for your customers.
And at 2200 hours, of course, it is the Monocle Daily. For the time being, I've been Robert Bound. That's been Midori House. Thanks for tuning in.